Welcome to the Messianic Message. I'm Kimberly Rogers Brown. We're going to open the book of Hebrews today, but before we do that, I want to give you just a little bit more understanding about the order of Melchizedek. The history of the Melchizedeks can be seen in various ways throughout the scriptures, from Genesis to Revelation. I have shown you some of those in the other teachings. I want to show you another important way to know what you're looking at when you read the phrase, the Most High God. The Bible's reference to the Most High God is an important allusion to the order of Melchizedek. We must understand what our forebears knew. The order of Melchizedek in the earliest times and in ancient Israel was commonly understood. The phrase Most High God is a special title connecting the earthly Melchizedek with the heavenly one. It first appears in Genesis 14 when the Melchizedek of Salem, Shem, blessed Abram, and Abram swore his oath to the Most High God in Genesis 14 verses 18 to 22. It says there in Genesis 14:18, "And Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought forth bread and wine, and he was the priest of the Most High God." The earthly Melchizedek is a king priest of the Most High God. In Genesis 14, verses 19 and 20, he says, "And he blessed him and said, Blessed be Abram of the Most High God, possessor of heaven and earth, and blessed be the Most High God, which has delivered your enemies into your hand, and he, Abram, gave him, Shem, tithes of all." Abram's tithe as a new vassal to the Melchizedek was a tribute paid by Abram to Yahweh, the Most High God. People only paid tribute to the king they served. If they paid any other king, it was considered treason. The tithes to Yahweh were the wages of a priest to Yahweh also. Tithes were paid to the priest, but it was understood that the one being paid was Yahweh, who, in turn, was paying wages to his earthly priest that represented him. A further detail of Abram's transaction with Melchizedek is in the next verse, 22. "And Abram said to the king of Sodom, I have lift up my hand to the Lord, Yahweh, the Most High God, the possessor of heaven and earth." Not only did Melchizedek bless Abram, but there was an additional action taken, swearing loyalty to the Most High God. This oath was the oath of the earthly Melchizedek office. Shem had selected his successor, and later on, an entire nation would take this oath at Mount Sinai. The Bible won't have this reference again, the Most High God, until Psalms 78:56. "Yet they tempted and provoked the Most High God and kept not his testimonies." This reference was written about 1,200 years after the Genesis 14 account. I bring this up to show you that our ancient Israelite ancestors had an assumption about the existence of the order of Melchizedek and its Most High God. Only the heavenly Melchizedek is also the Most High God. The Most High God appears in the book of Daniel when the house of Judah, the Jews, were in their 70-year Babylonian exile. The account of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego tells us there was still knowledge of the Melchizedek as the Most High God. Daniel 3:26. "Then Nebuchadnezzar came near to the mouth of the burning fiery furnace and spoke and said, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, you servants of the Most High God, come forth and come here. Then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came forth from the midst of the fire." Now this is the first time that servants who were not Melchizedek's were connected with the Most High God. The reason for this is because the earthly Melchizedeks could not operate outside the promised land. The heavenly Melchizedek's headquarters is in Salem, which is later Jerusalem. The earthly Melchizedek king can only rule and reign from Jerusalem, and it will be that the vassal king priests of the order of Melchizedek will go out around the earth to rule the nations and teach them the Torah as vassals. But, and this is a big but, the heavenly Melchizedek follows his people into their exiles, where then they become servants of the order of Melchizedek, but not in king-priest capacity. The heavenly Melchizedek king rules the entire earth from heaven, the account of Nebuchadnezzar being driven from his throne until he acknowledged that his right to rule over the house of Judah came from Yahweh is found in Daniel 5:21. And Nebuchadnezzar was driven from the sons of men, and his heart was made like the beasts, and his dwelling was with the wild asses. They fed him with grass like oxen, and his body was wet with the dew of heaven, till he knew that the Most High God ruled in the kingdom of men, and that he appoints over it whomsoever he will. The reason for showing you this is twofold. First, to realize that the order of Melchizedek is always with us. Right now, our people know almost nothing about the order of Melchizedek, unlike our ancestors from Genesis to Revelation. This is a problem, because there are qualifications of loyalty and commandment-keeping in order to have a chance to serve in this special capacity in the future. That's why we're going to look in the book of Hebrews. Loyalty has to do with not worshiping other gods, and commandment-keeping has to do with not picking and choosing, subtracting, or adding to what you want to keep. Second, to realize that there are times in our history when no earthly counterpart Melchizedek has been ruling with the heavenly one. Such was the case when Jacob's family went into exile in Egypt in Genesis, and again from the time of the Babylonian captivity to today. The brothers set the fate of the family when they rejected Joseph as the chosen firstborn. His coat of many colors symbolized his family status as the next Melchizedek after Jacob. However, Yahweh provided for the family when they were sent into exile, as we know from Genesis 50:20. Yeshua Yahweh Elohim did not leave them without provision in their exile. This exilic pattern of provision has always been with the people of Israel in all their scatterings. To be removed from the promised land is to lose the right to serve in the order of Melchizedek, but not to lose all the blessings of provision, so long as we are obeying the commandments while in exile as much as possible. This is the biggest reason why God's people today do not know and understand the order of Melchizedek. The house of Israel has been scattered for 2,700 years, the house of Judah for 2,500. They have never ruled their own territory as sovereigns since the Babylonian captivity, except for a few years. Even today, since 1948, the Jews in Israel are still in exile. They serve the United Nations and not the Most High God. Joseph never served as Melchizedek. He provided for the family as Pharaoh's vassal, according to Genesis 45:18. Melchizedek cannot serve another king at the same time he is serving the heavenly Melchizedek. However, Joseph's Egyptian provision would only be good until the deaths of Jacob and then Joseph. While Joseph was still alive, we read something peculiar about a group called the priests in Genesis 47, starting at verse 22. Only the land of the priests bought he not, that's during the famine, for the priests had a portion assigned them of Pharaoh, and did eat their portion, which Pharaoh gave them, and therefore they sold not their lands. Then Joseph said to the people, Behold, I have bought you this day and your land for Pharaoh. So Joseph is talking in verse 23 to the Egyptians, and he says, Here is seed for you, you shall sow the land. And it shall come to pass in the increase that you shall give the fifth part to Pharaoh, and four parts shall be your own, for seed of the field and your food, and for them of your households, and for the food of your little ones. And they said, You have saved our lives. Let us find grace in the sight of my Lord, and we will be Pharaoh's servants. And Joseph made it a law over the land of Egypt to his day, throughout his day. It says this day, but it meant to that day when Moses was writing it, that Pharaoh should have the fifth part, except the land of the priests only, which became not Pharaoh's. Who are these priests? Well, some claim they were the Egyptian priests. This is not so. The word for priests is Kohanim in Genesis 47:22 and 26. These were the Hebrews, all 12 tribes. All the tribes were priests at this point. They were not enslaved yet. These were the same 12 tribes that would take an oath to become king priests in the order of Melchizedek at Mount Sinai, but they already viewed themselves as priests in the order of Melchizedek. Pagan priests were called Kamarim in 2 Kings 23:5, Hosea 10:5, and Zephaniah 1:4, which says, I will also stretch out my hand upon Judah and upon all the inhabitants of Jerusalem, and I will cut off the remnant of Baal from this place, and the name of the Kamarims with the priests. The Kamarim are the pagan priests. The words Kohanim and Kemarim both begin with the kaf, which is pronounced as a K sound, like in the word kiss. The word is Strong's H3649, Kamar, in the singular, and Kamarim in the plural. And I don't know why the King James translator chose this incorrect English spelling. This is despite the fact that the Egyptian government required all firstborns to serve in Egyptian temples, serving other gods. The names of those gods had to be wiped off of the doorposts at the first Passover when they came out of Egypt. Now, Joseph was the Pharaoh for all intents and purposes, and for this reason, his Hebrew family were spared the hardships of the Egyptians during the famine because of Joseph's promise to them in chapter 45. In verse 10, it says, And you shall dwell in the land of Goshen, and you shall be near to me, you and your children and your children's children, and your flocks and your herds and all that you have, and there will I nourish you, for yet there are 5 years of famine, lest you and your household and all that you have come to poverty. And in verse 17, Pharaoh said to Joseph, Say to your brethren, This do ye, lade your beasts and go, get you into the land of Canaan, and take your father and your households and come to me, and I will give you the good of the land of Egypt, and you shall eat the fat of the land. The Hebrews, all 12 tribes, had a special provision given to them by Joseph and upheld by Pharaoh that the Egyptians did not get. Now, the years between Joseph and Moses, though, saw one huge change in their status. Instead of continuing to be elevated among the Egyptians, they were demoted to lower status than the Egyptians and were persecuted just for being Hebrews after Joseph died. We read about this in Exodus 1:8, where it says, "Now there arose up a new king over Egypt, which knew not Joseph." The point is to know who the priests were that Joseph provided the stipend of food for in Genesis 47:22-26. These were the Hebrews, all 12 tribes. They were not enslaved yet. Coming to this understanding is important for Yahweh telling the Israelites that they were to be a kingdom of priests and a holy nation later in Exodus 19:6. They already knew they were called to be a Melchizedek nation. The years between Joseph and Moses, though, saw one huge change in their status. Instead of being elevated among the Egyptians, they were demoted to lower status than the Egyptians and were persecuted just for being Hebrews after Joseph died. The book of Hebrews is about refocusing our attention to the order of Melchizedek after the fall of the temple and explaining how Yeshua is now both the earthly and heavenly Melchizedek and why. The order of Melchizedek was known to Yeshua's disciples. The writer of Hebrews did not introduce neither a forgotten nor a new concept. Mark chapter 5 verse 2 says, "And when he," that's Yeshua, "was come out of the ship, immediately there met him out of the tombs a man with an unclean spirit, who had his dwelling among the tombs, and no man could bind him, no, not with chains, because that he had been often bound with fetters and chains, and the chains had been plucked asunder by him, and the fetters broken in pieces, neither could any man tame him. And always, night and day, he was in the mountains and in the tombs, crying and cutting himself with stones. But when he saw Yeshua afar off, he ran and worshipped him, and cried with a loud voice, and said, 'What have I to do with you, Yeshua, you Son of the Most High God? I adjure you by God that you torment me not.'" This man recognized the Son of the heavenly Melchizedek. No one who was with Yeshua expressed surprise that Yeshua was the Son of the Most High God or asked for a definition of Most High God. They all knew that the Melchizedek is directly related to the Most High God. When Paul was proselytizing in Asia Minor, someone else recognized him and the men with him as servants of the Most High God, Acts 16:16. "And it came to pass, as we went to prayer, a certain damsel possessed with a spirit of divination met us, which brought her masters much gain by soothsaying. The same followed Paul and us and cried, saying, 'These men are the servants of the Most High God, which show to us the way of salvation.'" Again, saying Most High God is a reference throughout the scriptures to the order of Melchizedek. We have to ask ourselves why it was the demon-possessed that knew the order of Melchizedek had come to earth in the body of Yeshua, and Yahweh's own people, the Jews, did not see it. It is because by the time of the Assyrian and Babylonian captivities, the whole house of Israel had rejected their own status as priests in the order of Melchizedek, even the Levites. They had departed from Yahweh's commandments and led the Israelites into image worship and idolatry. After that, they can no longer see who they are. They needed the Messiah, who is also the heavenly Melchizedek in human body, and who is also their God and King, to reveal that to them. But they rejected Yeshua, so they were unable to see. The demons, however, have always known and recognized the Melchizedek. Let's go directly to one of those most troubling passages in the book of Hebrews, which is Hebrews 7, verses 11 and 12. If, therefore, perfection were by the Levitical priesthood, for under it the people received the law, what further need was there that another priest should rise after the order of Melchizedek and not be called after the order of Aaron? For the priesthood being changed, there is made of necessity a change also of the law. It is this passage and some later passages in the book of Hebrews that Christian doctrine uses as proof that the law of Moses was done away. It is a great leap from the law being changed to it being completely done away with. And certainly some of the law remains within Christianity, especially those socializing commandments that even the Gentiles obey, as Paul says in Romans 2:14, for when the Gentiles, which have not the law of Moses, do by nature the things contained in the law, these, having not the law, are a law to themselves. Yahweh's people are to live up to his higher than the heathen standards, which require embracing the whole law of Moses. How can even the atheists know to keep the social governing aspects of Yahweh's law? Because the law of Moses, it's Yahweh's law that he gave to Moses, is written on our hearts because we are the Melchizedek's kids. Every human on earth is related to Noah, the Melchizedek. We inherit from our parents what is written in the DNA. The law is written in the DNA as well as the record of our parents' sins. This is why Yahweh can visit the sins of the father on the children to the third and fourth generation, Deuteronomy 5:9, and that we individually have to take responsibility for our ancestors' sins when we repent, Leviticus 26, verses 40 to 42. All who live without the law of Moses will die without the law of Moses. You're just going to die because that's the way it is, because death is the consequence of our inherited physical nature, inherited from Adam and Eve. Romans 2:12, for as many as have sinned without law shall perish without law, and as many as have sinned in the law shall be judged by the law. Those who lived and died without ever having come to Yahweh's law, meaning the Gentiles, will die unredeemed. And those who are Yahweh's people but who sin against the law and die in their sins will be judged by the law, will remain unredeemed, and not be allowed to enter into eternal life. Romans 2:13. For not the hearers of the law are just before God, but the doers of the law shall be justified. So you're required to keep the law. For when the Gentiles, which have not the law, do by nature the things contained in the law, these, having not the law, are a law to themselves, which show the work of the law written in their hearts, their conscience also bearing witness, and their thoughts the mean, while accusing or else excusing one another. The Gentiles' social and personal laws, their social and personal Torahs, differ from culture to culture, and the consequences of disobeying cultural and societal Torahs also differ. But they know they have laws, and so they accuse each other with their social and personal Torahs, and also excuse each other according to their personal preferences. This is not how the Torah works. The law of Moses, the Torah, is the great equalizer, the great social leveler. It treats everyone the same, from the priest and king to the poorest slave or the man living on the street. Christian doctrine justifies rejecting Yahweh's whole Torah, the whole law of Moses, by keeping some of the commandments and adding religious commandments to their law. Part of that justification comes from the claim that the law was changed, Hebrews chapter 7, and if the law was changed by Yahweh, then most certainly the people can further change the law and even outlaw the basics of the Torah, starting with the second and fourth commandments about not having other gods before Yahweh and remembering to keep the Sabbath on the seventh day and not the first. The change in the law in Hebrews 7, 11, and 12 is taught as Yahweh doing away with the Levite priesthood. To understand that the Levite priesthood was not done away, we only need to see in Ezekiel 44 that the Levites will once again serve in Yeshua's temple in the millennium. Why was the law changed? Yeshua, Yahweh Elohim, always had a plan to have a Melchizedek human counterpart on the earth as his vassal to represent his heavenly kingdom. He created Adam for that purpose, but he chose Israel to be a kingdom of priests to him to represent his interests on the earth, namely, to bring all the nations to himself. But some rebellion on the part of the Israelites brought about a change. The change was not a change in Yahweh's plan or his law, but a change that affected the Israelites. Exodus 19:1, in the third month, when the children of Israel were gone forth out of the land of Egypt, the same day came they into the wilderness of Sinai, for they were departed from Rephidim, and were come to the desert of Sinai, and had pitched in the wilderness, and there Israel camped before the mount. And Moses went up to God, and Yahweh called to him out of the mountain, saying, Thus shall you say to the house of Jacob, and tell the children of Israel, You have seen what I did to the Egyptians, and how I bare you on eagle's wings, and brought you to myself. Eagle's wings will bring Yahweh's woman to the wilderness again in Revelation 12:14. Exodus 19:5 says, Now therefore, if you will obey my voice indeed and keep my covenant, then you shall be a peculiar treasure to me above all people, for all the earth is mine. And you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words which you shall speak to the children of Israel. Notice that there is an if that precedes Yahweh's promise to the people that they will be his peculiar treasure above all the people of the earth. Their continuing as his peculiar people is contingent upon their obedience to keep the covenant that he will now make with them. This covenant will make them into a nation of Melchizedeks, a nation of firstborns, serving Yeshua Yahweh Elohim's interests on the earth. Exodus 19:7. And Moses came and called for the elders of the people, and laid before their faces all these words which the Lord commanded him. And all the people answered together. Now listen, they're taking an oath. Remember Abram's oath? The people answered together. They're taking an oath. And they said, All that the Lord has spoken we will do. And Moses returned the words of the people to the word. You know, the people did not ask about the terms of the covenant. They simply agreed that whatever Yahweh said, they would do. And I said before, this is an oath of the same kind that was taken by Abram before Shem, who represented the Most High God. Notice that their words were, all that the Lord has spoken, we will do. So the case could be made that they thought they already knew everything there was to know about the covenant. Perhaps they were agreeing with the Passover from Exodus 12 and circumcision and the Sabbath instructions in Exodus 16, along with the smidgen of Torah that they knew about in Egypt, and that would be all there was to this covenant. From here, they might have thought, we have it made in the shade, because we already know what this covenant is, and we already know how to be priests, Kamarim, since we were doing that in Egypt. How much different can it be serving as priest to Yahweh? Evidence for this train of thought that I'm suggesting to you begins in Exodus 20, when the people approached Moses to not allow Yahweh to speak to them anymore, Exodus 20, verses 18 to 21, and with Nadab and Abihu, who brought Egyptian incense to the altar on the first day of their service after their ordination, in Leviticus 10:1. Nadab and Abihu had been commanded about the incense, but disobeyed and were destroyed for it. But the beginning of the end for the Israelite firstborns came when they realized things were going to be much different and more would be required of them than they thought. Oh, isn't that the Christian attitude today? The third day after they made the oath, Yahweh appeared on Mount Sinai and they were overwhelmed. Right here, we see that they are not qualified to be Melchizedek priests, and they would, within 40 days, prove this to be true. Why were they not qualified to be Melchizedek priests? Because they did not have individual relationships with Yahweh. Israel is a corporate congregation comprised of individuals that each have personal relationships with Yahweh. Some members of the congregation did have this kind of relationship, Joshua, Caleb, and probably the men who were selected to oversee the building of the tabernacle, Bezaleel and Aholiab in Exodus 35, verses 30 and 34, probably had personal relationships with Yahweh. Moses, of course, had a personal relationship with Yahweh, as did Aaron. This lack of relationship with and faith in Yahweh would be the downfall of the newly ordained firstborn Melchizedek priests of Israel, the order of Melchizedek, holy nation, and it would require a change in the law. Exodus 32, starting at verse 1. And when the people saw that Moses delayed to come down out of the mount, the people gathered themselves together to Aaron and said to him, Up, make us gods, which shall go before us. For as for this Moses, the man that brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we wot not what has become of him. And Aaron said to them, Break off the golden earrings which are in the ears of your wives, of your sons, and of your daughters, and bring them to me. And all the people broke off the golden earrings which were in their ears and brought them to Aaron. And he received them at their hand and fashioned it with a graving tool after he made it a molten calf. And they said, These be thy gods, O Israel, which brought you up out of the land of Egypt. And when Aaron saw it, he built an altar before it, and Aaron made proclamation and said, Tomorrow is a feast to the Lord. Exodus 32:6 says, And they rose up early in the morning and offered burnt offerings and brought peace offerings, and the people sat down to eat and to drink and rose up to play. Their cowardice at Mount Sinai 40 days earlier now appears as lack of faith. The molten calf was declared to be Israel's Elohim, gods, as in a pantheon of gods that they knew only from Egypt. The calf was a resurrection of a destroyed Egyptian deity, either Hathor or her son Apis. The order of Melchizedek priests, serving under the Melchizedek heavenly high priest and king, are to have only one God, him. People get confused when the Bible talks about other gods and then tells the Israelite he is the only God. There are other gods. These are the nation's gods. Yeshua Yahweh Elohim is their God, the Israelites' God, alone. They are not to have other gods in their lives, not in their thoughts, their words, or their worship. The nations can have as many gods as they want. The nation of the one God, Israel, is to bring the nations to him and away from the gods who are nothing but fallen angels, which we also call demons. The Israelite Melchizedek priests also have a duty to uphold all of the law of Yahweh given to his people by Moses. We do not get to pick and choose which of the laws to keep and which to change or discard. Yahweh, though, has the right to make a change in the law. With the breaking of the covenant, the firstborns of Israel lost their right to serve. This golden calf incident would be only the first of the many ways they spit in Yahweh's face while he called them to repentance, even to the point of the Father's own Son taking on a human body to come and speak personally to his people, only to have them reject and kill him. The change in the law is that Yahweh substituted the entire tribe of Levi for the firstborns. But let's back up a little bit. I want to explain the redemption of the firstborns to help us understand the Levite substitution. And speaking of losing the right to serve, why didn't Aaron lose his right to serve and even to serve as high priest? It is because the Levites saved his behind by standing with Moses and killing the 3,000 men who led the Israelites into the golden calf worship. Now, moving on to understanding the redemption. The firstborns of Israel, both man and beast, were to be a redemption for all the firstborns that the Egyptians had lost because Pharaoh hardened his heart and would not let Israel leave Egypt. Exodus 13:2 says, "Sanctify to me all the firstborn that opens the womb among the children of Israel, both of man and of beast. It is mine." And Exodus 13:13-15 says, "Every firstling of an ass you shall redeem with a lamb. And if you will not redeem it, then you shall break his neck, and all the firstborn of man among your children shall you redeem. And it shall be, when your son asks you in times to come, saying, 'What is this?' that you shall say unto him, 'By strength of hand the Lord brought us out from Egypt, from the house of bondage. And it came to pass, when Pharaoh would hardly let us go, that the Lord slew all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, both the firstborn of man and the firstborn of beast. Therefore I sacrifice to Yahweh all that opens the matrix, being males, but all the firstborn of my children I redeem.'" The Israelite firstborns take the place of those lost by the Egyptians. Redeeming the Israelite firstborns was a way for Yahweh to do justice for those whose lives he had taken because of Pharaoh's rebellion. Yahweh never allows others to pay the price of death for the sins of someone else. Thus, the purpose of the redemption of the firstborn man and beasts is to replace what Yahweh, by necessity, had to take from Pharaoh in order to get the Israelites released from Egypt. Yahweh is doing justice to the Gentile Egyptians because he is a just God and king. Those Egyptian firstborns died in their own sins and were worthy of death. But because Yahweh had to remove them to save his people, he will do justice for the payment of their lives. And might I add that killing all the firstborns also did away with the firstborn worship of demons in the Egyptian temples, at least for a while. How much greater is his justice then to his own people? This redemption is repeated in Exodus 34:20. But the firstling of an ass you shall redeem with a lamb, and if you redeem him not, then you shall break his neck. All the firstborn of your sons you shall redeem, and none shall appear before me empty. This repetition of the law was given again as a covenant renewal. Israel has had many covenant renewals with Yahweh. The New Testament is not a new covenant in the sense of that it is different or new from what was established in Exodus. The new covenant is a renewal, just like the renewal in Exodus 34 after the golden calf incident. Exodus 34 once begins with exactly the same thing as in Exodus 20's covenant, the Ten Commandments. The commandments were written in earthly stone the second time, instead of what was written the first time, and the renewed covenant was made with Moses only. The people were not present for this one. They had rejected the first covenant. Moses had broken the heavenly tablets as a sign of their rebellion to show them the deal was off. And so Moses, after interceding for the people, had to present himself before Yahweh with two hand-hewn stone tablets, and he had to come alone. Yahweh revealed to Moses what kind of God and king he is and would be to the Israelite in Exodus 34:6-7. The Lord passed by before him and proclaimed, "Yahweh, Yahweh Elohim, merciful and gracious, long-suffering and abundant in goodness and truth, keeping mercy for thousands, forgiving iniquity and transgression and sin, and that will by no means clear the guilty, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children and upon the children's children to the third and to the fourth generation." Some promises would be made to Moses in Exodus 34:10-11. And he said, "Behold, I make a covenant. Before all your people, I will do marvels." This is the covenant with Moses. So before Moses, Yahweh is going to do marvels before all of Moses' people, such as have not been done in all the earth, nor in any nation. And all the people among which you are shall see the work of the Lord. The Israelites will see the work of the Lord from this covenant that I'm making with you, Moses. For it is a terrible thing that I will do with you. And I think part of that has to do with when Moses came down from the mountain, his face was glowing and everybody was afraid of him. Verse 11, "Observe you that which I command you this day. Behold, I will drive out before you the Amorite, the Canaanite, the Hittite, Perizzite, the Hittite, Hivite rather, and the Jebusite." Now, there are requirements that Yahweh expects from the Israelites in return for this renewal. Exodus 34:12. "Take heed to yourself, lest you make a covenant with the inhabitants of the land where you go, lest it be for a snare in the midst of you. But you shall break their altars, break their images," their matzebah, which are pillars dedicated to their gods, "and cut down their groves," or their asherah. "For you shall worship no other god, for the Lord whose name is jealous is a jealous god." This is a lesson that Yahweh's people do not believe to this day. The Jews, Christians, and Muslims all worship gods that are not Yahweh. Now, they call their gods by Yahweh's name, and, you know, they get hopping mad when they're told they're not worshiping Yahweh, but some other god of their own making. Their calling their gods by Yahweh's name is exactly what was done at the golden calf in Exodus 32:5. Yahweh continued giving a few more of the basics of the previous covenant with them. He had not done away with the rest of what was previously given. The renewal was one of those all-encompassing things. It was the et al that is used today still in contracts to be understood as covering everything else that was given in the contract, in the covenant. It is significant that Yahweh renewed the covenant only with Moses. This was done to make it clear that his promises for Israel are connected directly with their obedience to the Torah. The firstborns of Israel are now disqualified to serve as Melchizedek's, even though they still must be redeemed to replace all the firstborns of the Egyptians. The Levites will now replace the firstborns of Israel. The tribe of Levi alone will now represent the order of Melchizedek on the earth. Numbers 3:12. And I, behold, I have taken the Levites from among the children of Israel instead of all the firstborn that opens the matrix among the children of Israel. Therefore, the Levites shall be mine. And you shall take the Levites for me, I am the Lord, instead of all the firstborn among the children of Israel and the cattle of the Levites, instead of all the firstlings among the cattle of the children of Israel, in Numbers 3:41 and Numbers 3:45, take the Levites instead of all the firstborn among the children of Israel and the cattle of the Levites, instead of their cattle, and the Levites shall be mine, I am Yahweh. Numbers 8:15-18 says, after that shall the Levites go in to do the service of the tabernacle of the congregation, and you shall cleanse them and offer them for an offering. For they are wholly given to me from among the children of Israel, instead of such as open every womb, instead of the firstborn of all the children of Israel have I taken them to me. For all the firstborn of the children of Israel are mine, both man and beast. On the day that I smote every firstborn in the land of Egypt, I sanctified them for myself. But I have taken the Levites for all the firstborn of the children of Israel. You see, Yahweh did indeed establish Israel as his order of Melchizedek nation by substituting the Levite tribe for all the firstborns of all the tribes. This was the change in the law. It did not do away with the law or the priesthood. It was here, though, that the Melchizedek offices were split. The king function was separated from the priest function. The Levites never were permitted to act as kings, and when Yahweh established the kings over Israel at their request, the kings were never permitted to act as priests. In the future, this office will be restored, and the order of Melchizedek king priests will function in both capacities. Revelation 5:10 says that we have been made to, he has made us unto our God kings and priests. Yeshua has made us unto our God kings and priests, and we shall reign on the earth. So we will be Melchizedek's that function as both king and priest, just like Shem and Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and Noah and all of those former Melchizedek's and Adam. One more item before I go. Moses told us that the Hebrews had not known the name Yahweh until it was revealed to him. Exodus 6, 2 and 3 says, "And God spoke to Moses and said to him, I am Yahweh, and I appeared to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob by the name of God Almighty, but my name, Yahweh, was not known to them." Well, Moses did not know God's name was Yahweh, so this had to be explained to him quickly. Many people already know this, so why am I bringing it up here if people already know? Well, it's because we need to understand the significance of the name Yahweh. This is Yeshua's king name, his royal name, the one he wanted the Israelites to call on when approaching him as their king. He is God in need of earthly human counterparts to uphold to the nations his godness as the creator. And now he comes as the king, which they had not known before. And he's going to appear to us again with a name that only he knows and we do not know yet. So this is going to be repeated in the future. Revelation 19:12. The people rejected him as their king in Samuel's time. He gave them a king function that did not produce but a few righteous kings, and only for short periods of time. The change in the law was the taking of the entire Levite tribe to substitute for all the firstborn Israelites for their service. And even though they corrupted their office and had to be exiled with those from the tribes of Judah, Benjamin, Simeon, and any others with the Jews, the Levites get an everlasting and forever service to Yahweh. This service will be restored to them in the millennium. This has been Kimberly Rogers Brown from TheMessianicMessage.com. Thank you for listening.